Jobs are number one in this economy right now. I have said that before. Supply chains, though, are a very close second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 19th of May. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Our lead story today is one of demand and supply, in that order. The commodity in question is semiconductors. The demand, as we'll explain in a minute, is nearly universal. The supply, well, it's lagging, and more so every day. Bloomberg got its hands on some data from the Susquehanna Financial Group that says if you order a chip today, the aforementioned semiconductors, you are going to have to wait 17 weeks for it to be delivered, 4+ months. That is, to put it mildly, no way to run a supply chain. And as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, it is doing damage to way more than cars or computers or smartphones.
These days, almost everything has a chip, whether we think of it as high tech or not.
If it has a plug or a battery, it probably has chips in it.
Glenn O'Donnell, research director at Forrester, says that includes refrigerators, video doorbells, and light bulbs you can turn on with your phone, and even lower tech things like kids' toys.
Because, you know, all the toys got to talk now and they got to react and they have little motors.
Right now, there's a shortage of all kinds of chips, even the most basic ones, says Anand Srinivasan, an analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
So it doesn't matter if it's a $100 part or if it's a 50-cent part.
There's just not enough capacity at factories around the world to meet the demand from all of the industries that need chips. Because there's such a shortage, the semiconductor industry is having to pick and choose what to prioritize, says Mario Morales at market research company IDC.
It sort of prioritizes the large-scale areas like computing. Mobile phones is the largest market. So those supply chains are always going to get priority.
And other companies, especially smaller ones, are going to have to wait longer for chips. So Srinivasan at Bloomberg says if you need something like a new appliance anytime soon, even if you don't care about it being smart,
all of those products will be in short supply, so you better get in line.
And Srinivasan says the shortage is likely to get worse before it gets better. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The scarcity of those chips for appliances and oh so much more is holding up construction projects, and as we told you last week, so too is a shortage of building materials, lumber in particular. Retailers that carry that kind of thing are doing real well so far this year. Home Depot and Lowe's just reported solid first quarter profits, thank you. But think for a second about what short supply means. Retailers don't have enough product to meet demand. Yes, they can raise prices. We talked about pricing power the other day, and a lot of retailers have. But customers do have some limits, you know. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gives us the Econ 101 on this.
Ed Carroll and his wife bought a house in Cleveland in March, and they were hoping to build a fence in the yard so their dogs could run around.
We do have a fence there now, but it's not a great one. They have actually been able to get out of it before.
He also wanted to build shelves for some collectibles, video games and bobblehead dolls. Then they found out the price of lumber.
It would have been easily like $200-$300 to build a couple of the shelves that we wanted to.
Never mind what the fence would have cost. So they're going without both for now. The collectibles are still sitting in a cardboard box. Here's the conundrum retailers are facing. On the one hand, demand's not a bad thing. Gus Fauché is chief economist at PNC.
You're much better off with the retailer having too much demand than too little demand.
But when demand is high, suppliers, manufacturers, lumber mills can raise the prices they charge retailers, and they have. Joel Rampolt at the consulting firm Alex Partners says for retailers, then,
classical economics would say, well, your costs are going up and there's more demand in the marketplace. No problem. Just raise your prices.
But practically speaking, yes. Problem.
The retailers can only go so far in raising prices before they start really angering their customers and damaging their own price perceptions.
Part of this has to do with how flexible customers are. If they need lumber for the frame of their house, maybe it's urgent. If they're browsing for dishwashers, maybe they decide to start hand washing. Yesterday, a Home Depot executive was talking about lumber and said basically, at this moment, it is hard to predict how many customers will be willing to walk away. Or at what price? I'm Mary Elsegarra for Marketplace.
Speaking of walking away, on Wall Street today, things started out bad, ended a little less bad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After George Floyd was murdered last year, we started a series of interviews looking at how racism is systemic in this economy. We heard about people's lives. We heard about economics as an academic discipline. We heard about finance. And we heard about economic data and how that data can really obscure what we understand if we don't take it apart a little bit. Disaggregate is the technical term. I talked to Dr. Rhonda Sharpe last year about data and the disaggregation of it, breaking groups out by gender and race, among other characteristics, to try to create effective economic policy by understanding how those groups are being affected. So we have gotten her back on the phone for an update here. Dr. Sharpe, welcome.
Thanks, Guy.
You and I started this conversation back last June when we had you on. And obviously, you know, you've been looking at this for a very long time. And it was a different time in this society and in this economy last June, different administration, obviously. I wonder what your sense is of whether the Biden administration is taking this on.
I think they are. But I don't know, his racial equity order says in Section 9 that data has to be disaggregated. So I'm super excited about that. But what I am advocating for as president of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race is that it won't be this trite disaggregation. I said in a Bloomberg article recently, I want to look at reports and see all of me. I want to see me as a ADOS woman. I want to see me as educated, as single, not married, ADOS, an American descendant of slaves. Like, I want to see all of me when I'm reading an article, not just me as a Black woman, because that hides so much of my experience in the U.S. just to talk about me as a Black woman.
So doing this is all in the service of getting more equitable and thus better policy that will help more Americans. My question is, if I'm Jay Powell and I'm disaggregating this data in all the ways you like, or Janet Yellen or Joe Biden, how does this then inform my policy decisions?
Well, I think that one of the things that it helps us to identify are not historical trends. And those historical trends help us to identify systemic inequalities. But it also helps with accountability, right? You know who you're supposed to help, and they know if you've helped them.
What do you suppose it looks like if we collectively, right, because it's our challenge, if we get this right?
So let me say what I think it doesn't look like. I don't think it means that we don't have inequality. We hear this conversation about an equitable recovery, but 1 year after 12 million women were unemployed, 8 million of them being white, white women have the lowest unemployment rate, and there's no conversation about that. Our unemployment numbers, as we're opening up, look like what we have historically seen. White unemployment is at a level, and for everyone else, it's nearly twice that. When we get this right, we can have honest conversations about our inequality, and then we can begin to have collective conversations about how do we address that.
Which I absolutely understand, and obviously we get better policy when that happens. But let me ask you the reality check question. The American economy is a $20 trillion beast. It is hard to maneuver and get policy decisions made in the best of times. Is it really possible to make these decisions at such a granular level, do you think?
So yes and no. And so my yes is we have seen that when we are concerned about the economy, when we are concerned about people, we move. I think what's most important about this and what I like to say is the beauty of disaggregating data is that every person, every business and sector can see themselves in the data. It influences, I think, just overall how we see America progressing towards an equitable society. And that's not a partisan issue.
Rhonda Vanche Sharp, she is the president of the Women's Institute for Science, Equity, and Race. Dr. Sharp, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
These are interesting times for businesses in this economy. You saw some big names take a stand against restrictive voting laws earlier this year. And then today, more than 200 companies, again, including some big ones like McDonald's and JP Morgan and Uber, they are working with the advocacy group Time's Up to promote policies that support caregivers and that help get women back to work. We have talked a bunch about what this pandemic has meant for women. More than 2 million of them have had to leave the labor force in the past year. So the new Care Economy Business Council, as it's called, is pushing for government policies to address that, including paid family leave. Again, it's a different kind of role for a big business, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports from the Workplace Culture Desk.
Michelle Keefe runs a staffing firm called Mom Up that specializes in placing mothers, and she's hearing a lot about childcare issues these days.
So many women that were job seeking with us did have to step away from their job search. Most of them didn't want to.
She's joined the Care Economy Business Council and believes the private sector needs to speak up about the lack of care infrastructure.
This is something that's been unveiled because of the pandemic, but this is something that is a systemic issue in our country, in the workplace.
But businesses haven't always been keen on the idea of government taking this over.
They say it's a job killer.
Eileen Applebaum has studied California's paid family leave policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. When California's six-week leave was adopted in 2002, business groups opposed it. But Applebaum found 6 years on, their fears were unfounded.
They told us productivity went up. Everybody told us morale went up.
Family-friendly policies can inspire loyalty and reduce turnover, but they can be costly for smaller companies, says finance professor Elena Patel at the University of Utah.
I think a federal paid leave policy makes it easier for businesses to offer what we think is a highly demanded sort of job benefit.
The U.S. is the only wealthy country without paid family leave. Because of that, such benefits have traditionally been seen as perks, says Caitlin Collins, a sociologist at Washington University.
Here in the United States, we think of caregiving and families in general as a private and personal responsibility.
But Collins says big business could start to change those attitudes by embracing caregiving benefits as an economic and public good. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I did some dancing in the shower this morning, a little bit of walking.
Got to get your daily exercise, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 164 points today, 0.4%, closed at 33,896. The Dow down almost 600 points at one point during the session. The NASDAQ basically flat, 13,299. The S&P 500 dipped 12 points, 0.2%. 41 and 15. As we heard from Sam Fields, there is a semiconductor chip shortage for everything. Cars, yes, sure, fine. Blenders, though, electric toothbrushes, thus Intel up 0.9%. Applied Materials gained 2.4% today. We heard today the European Union is going to begin opening its borders to vaccinated American travelers soon. And airlines, who've been waiting for this for months, are already getting in gear. JetBlue, which announced in February it's going to begin transatlantic flights this coming summer, is down 1.3% today. United Airlines down 1%. American Airlines down about 2.5%. Bonds down as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. It's listeners like you who make our journalism possible. And when you donate $7 a month, you can get our new Liquid Assets Mason Jar mug, along with some cocktail and mocktail recipes from my marketplace colleagues. Beer for me, and it goes well in any kind of container. Get yours by donating today at marketplace.org/donate. And cheers.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a survey out from Charles Schwab not too long ago that said 15% of all current stock market investors in this country first started investing last year. All that time stuck at home, nothing to do, I guess. In response, though, there has been a whole host of new apps designed to get first-timers, most notably young first-timers, more involved in investing. David McNunough founded one of those apps. It's called Common Stock. It's a social platform for information sharing, not a brokerage place to buy and sell. And when we talked the other day, I asked David McNunough about the growth in market participation.
When I step back, you know, that growth rate can't persist forever. You know, it's a cyclical sort of breathing thing where there was a lot of excitement in January. The market has cooled off in the short term, but it will come roaring back in terms of participation. And that's healthy. That's a good thing.
I guess my point, though, is that it is kind of cyclical. And if you and I had this conversation 15 February last year, right before the bottom fell out, you know, it would have been a different kettle of fish, as it were.
Yes. I mean, I think there's some historical context that I need to give, right, where, you know, I got started in 2008 at the very bottom of the financial crisis, yeah. Right? And over the decades since, everybody sort of in my age group watched this 10-year-plus, you know, bull run. So the moment the market actually plummeted in March, that's where you saw this influx, this flood of people who've been on the sidelines, who kind of missed the last run, who are now saying, this is my time to, you know, jump in and participate in the next wealth creation opportunity. And that's where we are today.
So what is your guess on what market participation looks like coming out of this pandemic? If we've got a bunch of younger people piling in now, do you think the percentage of people actually actively in the market is going to increase substantially?
When young people got stimulus checks, the popular thing to do was invest it. That's a remarkable, you know, transformational change in society. And so it's really interesting to see, especially the acute event that happened in January, you know, this old adage of invest in what you know. Well, young people know memes and they know internet culture. They know that their friends all like Peloton and they're discovering their force as the most meaningful market participant.
But are memes and internet culture a good, solid, long-term investing strategy?
Well, for sure, this is actually what Common Stock is looking to improve, because it's great that everyone's on Reddit talking about markets and investing. I want to harness this energy for, I guess, a little less risky and positive outcomes, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well, what I hear you saying is we need some guardrails, right? Because, look, as we learned with GameStop and some of the more unfortunate episodes there, this can go bad in a big, bad hurry.
It depends on the definition of bad. You know, one of the things that I think is really valuable is especially for younger investors to get exposure to the risks and learn that powerful lesson then. It sticks with you for life.
Yeah, but if you lose the rent money when you're 23, that's going to be a tough month for you.
Certainly. And by the way, I actually would caveat this with the vast majority of people are actually not really taking, you know, these super risky bets like that. The more common outcome is they will put money in some things that are more safe, sometimes more risky. And actually, this is the value of losing an investment at 23. You don't lose it at 33 when you have two kids and a mortgage, where it's way more damaging.
David McDonough, he's the founder, also the CEO of Common Stock. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
If you've had need to see your family doctor lately, there is a good chance you've been able to do it in person, given the current state of virus infections. But then again, maybe you decided to just keep on telemedicining. A lot of us got used to it over the past year, right? In Southern California, there's a family physician making a big bet against the return of the doctor's office visit. He sees patients entirely online or at their homes, and he tracks their medical data from wearable devices all the time. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on a high-tech doc building a business around a modern version of the old-school house call.
The doctor is in his car. Every day, San Diego family physician Michael Carisu drives from one patient to another. For this midday house call, he pulls out of his trunk, no kidding, a black bag. Inside?
Medical equipment, wipes, injections, the stethoscope.
Sound standard, but Carisu was also armed with wearable smartwatches and rings for his patients that track more than just steps.
Here's a few Oura rings, mainly used for sleep, but it's also tracking your heart rate variability, and your respiratory rate, and your core body temperature.
So by the time he walks through the door of, in this case, Dennis O'Connor,
I know what his sleep has been over the last week. I know what his heart rate has been.
Hey, Dennis, how's it going?
Real good. Come on in.
Back to the usual spot?
Right down the hall.
Seeing patients at home gives Dr. Carisu clues into how they eat and if they're at risk of falling. At Dennis's place, they geek out on his exercise numbers.
So I did some dancing in the shower this morning, a little bit of walking, and it measures my fitness level.
This is a new doctor model Carisu was trying. No office. He ditched his lease in the pandemic, saving $7,000 a month. And now he's on his own, practicing what he calls high-tech, high-touch medicine.
Take a big breath in here and out.
Like many innovations, Carisu's came out of necessity. For years, he worked at a clinic at UC San Diego and at a private practice, both shut down last spring.
There was no revenue stream coming in for me, so that pressure cooker situation allowed me to be really creative.
He began to see patients online and at their houses, which he'd never done. Most of his patients are on Medicare, which during the pandemic is paying doctors for these services. And from his house, Carisu logs on from what he calls Command Central.
I have the dashboard of data from a particular wearable device. Then I have another screen where I'll bring up the electronic medical record. And then another one where I can communicate directly with the patient. And, you know, another one that's just for telemedicine.
It does look a bit like NASA. This is exciting for a lot of doctors, including Dr. Dion Denmark, a neuroscientist and geneticist at Alta Medical. But she worries it's a little early to depend on data from wearables.
We're going to be making a whole bunch of spurious associations or thinking that the data means something that they don't. And we constantly need to be on the lookout for that. If the signal looks too good to be true, then it probably is.
It will take time for Carisu to show that data plus house calls can prevent disease and save the system money. It does make his patients happy. Dr. Randolph Gordon, a health industry consultant at Deloitte, says that's important.
Healthcare, like the rest of the economy, is moving to being consumer-directed. It's a matter of convenience. It's a matter of expectation.
Home visits are also helpful for Dr. Carisu's elderly patients. His next San Diego appointment, Tyler Orion, has mobility issues.
Get your round back, all right?
This being Southern California, they do the appointment in her backyard by her tomatoes and her collard plants. Dr. Mike is pleased with her data.
So you've been keeping your swims up.
Oh, yeah. And I love it when I get an attaboy from you and I finish my swim. And then I like immediately get a text from Mike that has something cute.
For all the smiles, Michael Caruso's venture faces an iffy future. Medicare could cut payments for home visits and telemedicine when the pandemic subsides. For now, though, this doc says house calls and virtual house calls are also better for him.
I'm getting more deep sleep. I mean, here and there, I still have two young boys, so that remains to be seen.
That's right. This high-tech family doc without an office tracks his analytics, too. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today comes to us from the minutes of the Federal Reserve's most recent meeting, which were released today. You know how Jay Powell has said the Fed isn't even talking about pulling back on its support for the economy? Well, they have started possibly, maybe, kinda talking about, sorta, could be, perhaps talking about it. Here is the actual quote from the minutes today. It might be appropriate at some point in upcoming meetings to begin discussing plan. Gotta love the Fed, right? All right, we gotta go, but here is your moment of economic context, just because you should know. Bitcoin fell as low as $32,000 overnight last night, half of what it was at its high a couple of months ago. Somebody let me know when it makes sense to buy pizza with Bitcoin, will you? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. The other ones coming in, so the rest of us don't have to. Most of the rest of us. Anyway, I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.